regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Very pleased that Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon is going to be with us here in just a moment or two. Going to be talking about the latest litigation filed in Colorado, taking on Denver's ban on so-called assault weapons, as well as the state of Colorado's ban on so-called large capacity magazines. We're also going to get an update on the other litigation that DOJ has filed, including its efforts to rein in the abuses of the LA Sheriff's Department regarding the issuance of concealed carry permits, and the latest in the lawsuit against the U.S. Virgin Islands as well, taking on a number of provisions of Virgin Islands gun law. Before we get to the conversation with Harmy Dillon, though, I do want to give you an update. You know, on Thursday, we spoke with Lee Williams, an investigative journalist for the Second Amendment Foundation, and we were talking about this diesel therapy that Patrick Tate Adamiak was about to be subjected to, basically 50 days in the back of a van driving around the country. He is currently being incarcerated in New Jersey. He's got a court hearing coming up, I believe, in late June in Alexandria, Virginia. It's about 100 miles between the two places. So why on earth they moved him or were planning on moving him 50 days beforehand is beyond me. But the good news is Lee updated his story, I believe it was yesterday morning, Sunday morning, and the diesel therapy has been rescinded. Patrick Tate Adamiak will be staying in the Fort Dix prison until it's time for that hearing in Virginia, at which time he will be moved a matter of, you know, hours, if not just a day or two beforehand, not the month-long trip that Adamiak was about to be subjected to. And Lee says that there were multiple officials, including ATF officials, who worked to stop this diesel therapy from taking place. And, you know, don't have any names or anything, but that is very good news. I don't know, again, if it's even within the realm of possibility that the DOJ would suddenly reverse course and say, hey, you know what, this whole prosecution was wrong. I mean, that is truly unprecedented, or at least extraordinarily rare, while a case is still being appealed. But I'm keeping my fingers crossed that, the Supreme Court takes an interest in Adamiak's case. His cert petition is scheduled to be considered in conference this Friday. I'm also hopeful that members of the Trump administration will keep pressing the president to take action and issue a full pardon to Patrick Tate Adamiak. The fact that there were senior ATF officials, according to Lee, who helped stop this diesel therapy from taking place, again, that's an interest. It shows that there's an interest, at least to some degree, within the Trump administration towards helping Tate Adamiak. Whether those voices, again, can lend their support for a pardon, I guess remains to be seen. But I am pleased to see that we were able to stop at least this particular abuse for Patrick Tate Adamiak. And again, I want to thank Lee for all of his coverage of the continuing saga that Mr. Adamiak is going through. All right. So with that in mind, let's turn our attention to today's conversation with Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division, which now has, for the first time in history, a Second Amendment section. Barry Arrington, who formerly was working with National Association for Gun Rights, Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, serving as the acting head of the Second Amendment section. And it wasn't long after Barry Arrington got hired by DOJ that we saw the lawsuits against the city of Denver and the state of Colorado filed. So we've got, again, a lot to talk about with Harmy Dillon. Take a look and a listen. Assistant Attorney General, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Cam.
My pleasure. And boy, there's a lot to talk about since we last spoke. I think it was in December. We've seen a couple new pieces of litigation filed In Colorado, taking on the ban on so-called assault weapons in Denver, and then the state's ban on quote-unquote large capacity magazines. What can you tell us about why you decided to file suit against these particular restrictions in the state of Colorado?
Well, let's talk about the restrictions themselves. And this is a type of tactic that jurisdictions all over the country that would love to continue banning guns, but no, they can't legally in the wake of Bruin and Heller are trying out. They're trying to modify their local restrictions in a way that they think will evade review, but they really won't. So what they're doing in each of these cases is, okay, fine, you can have firearms, but you can't have them with the magazines they're sold with, which imposes an additional expense, Colorado's law calling magazines that are standard issue for many firearms like the Glock 17 or like AR-15 magazines that are standard, they're calling them large capacity to sort of demagogue them. That's kind of fake and misleading. And then in the case of Denver, of course, they are doing something that the District of Columbia, Illinois, and some other jurisdictions are doing, which is banning AR-15s or that type of semi-automatic rifle, which is extremely popular in the United States, altogether. And while that type of a tactic may have been colorable or plausible under earlier case law, it's clear from recent Supreme Court jurisprudence that when you combine, for example, the Smith and Wesson case recently, the Cargill decision in the Supreme Court recently, together with Bruin and the analysis that goes back to the founding and says that firearms restrictions have to be consistent with what was the original understanding of the founders. And if a firearm or associated accessory is widely used by law-abiding citizens in the United States, it's presumptively legal under the Second Amendment. So what we're doing is tying all those cases and all those threads together to strike down this legislation. Now, you asked me the question of why Colorado? There's already bad case law in some jurisdictions and to a lesser degree, some good case law in other jurisdictions. And so in the 10th Circuit, where Colorado is, there's really no case law on this issue of semi-automatic rifles or magazine restrictions. And so we're seeking to establish that precedent and then ultimately get this decided before the Supreme Court.
You know, you talk about some of these other jurisdictions where bad case law already exists. I know that you have warned the Virginia legislature as well as the Governor Spanberger that if they try to enact this gun ban bill that passed this year, that the DOJ would be filing suit. The Fourth Circuit has previously upheld Maryland's ban on so-called assault weapons. So you're dealing with that issue. When you have those jurisdictions with bad case law, does that actually help expedite taking a case up to the Supreme Court? I mean, if the district court says, well, I'm compelled to follow what the Fourth Circuit has said, does this maybe like move these cases along a little bit quicker?
It does. And I mean, I want to just say, first of all, I clerked in the Fourth Circuit, some great judges there, but the Fourth Circuit is, I think, plainly wrong on the Second Amendment in light of the most recent jurisprudence from the court and the clear direction the court's going. And I personally argued this in the 11th Circuit and, they pointed to the Fourth Circuit in the briefing and, the Fourth Circuit is wrong. So we're not going to accept that. And every opportunity that we have a state passing an illegal law, that gives us an opportunity to get the Fourth Circuit or another court to revisit their bad jurisprudence. Fifth Circuit has had some rulings and, there's inconsistency even within circuits on these issues. And so the more inconsistency there is, the more likely it is the United States Supreme Court will take up a issue of constitutional importance. And so, but the court typically will decline to take things up when there isn't a fully developed body of differing views that they can decisively determine. And so I think that's kind of just a natural way we look at Supreme Court precedent. I know a lot of people out there in the Second Amendment community, every time I file a lawsuit, there's a number of nasty remarks afterwards jumping up and down and saying, but you're ignoring fill in the blank, my state. We're not ignoring those jurisdictions. We are simply being strategic in our litigation choices and trying to get things resolved as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Listen, you know as well as I do, on social media, you can say this guy is blue and you're going to get 50 people arguing that actually, no, it's bright red. I hope that people will listen to your explanation about the strategy that's involved here, because, you know, you can't go after, first of all, even with the federal government, you all are dealing with finite resources, a finite number of attorneys who can, you know, participate in a finite number of cases, right? So that's for right. you to challenge every unconstitutional gun law that's in place across the country right now would be a fool's errand. I mean, quite honestly, I will say, as a Virginian, I hope that you do challenge, you know, as many of the gun control laws that are set to take effect on July the 1st as possible. But I do understand the strategy involved. Which takes us to one of the other cases I wanted to bring up, the case against the U.S. Virgin Islands. This was interesting because, you know, Virgin Islands has some very unique gun control laws. Their storage mandate requires, not only is it a one-size-fits-all policy, but it requires safes to be, like, bolted to the floor. The complaint that DOJ filed also alleged that they are taking their sweet time and processing the licensing applications. Since then, the governor recently signed an executive order basically declaring every government building leased or owned by the government to be a gun-free zone. It doesn't matter if there's any security there whatsoever. What is the possibility of the DOJ filing an amended complaint to take on the governor's executive order? Because, I mean, again, not only does it seem to violate the Constitution, this wasn't even passed through the legislature. This was just a governor deciding via executive fiat that no, those folks who are licensed to carry in the Virgin Islands, a very small number of people, all of a sudden now these spaces are off limits to them.
Well, I can't really comment on the sensitive spaces issue because we haven't taken that up as yet. And, okay. You know, here in the building I'm sitting right now is a sensitive space, and as are most all federal buildings where law enforcement takes place for good reason, you know, that may be something that is challenged in the future. And the executive order versus legislature issue is certainly something that a citizen there could challenge with standing regarding due process in the Virgin Islands, which is part of the United States. But as to the challenges that we've already brought, they're just bread and butter at this point, that the Virgin Islands is blatantly ignoring Bruin, which is the law of the land. We used to have similar restrictions to what we're taking on in the Virgin Islands, and my home state of California and San Francisco had certain restrictions, which were all theoretical, as they would never give you a CCW permit in the first place. So a lot of people didn't even have firearms, or they had them, but they couldn't carry them. And so the storage mandate, the slow walking, which is something we're also challenging in Los Angeles County vis-a-vis the Sheriff's Department, taking 3 years to issue and process CCW permits there. And the requirement that you purchase all of this preparation to own a firearm even before they give you the permit, I mean, it's all ridiculous and inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent. So we feel pretty good about that case. That case is in discovery, and you know, there's a mediation coming up in that case this summer. And so hopefully soon we'll be able to announce that the people in the Virgin Islands enjoy the same rights as the rest of us here on the mainland.
I was going to ask, I mean, I saw the mediation, this docket, I think, for June. Is that an opportunity? Is that an off ramp, I guess, for the Virgin Islands to avoid going to trial by simply adopting, you know, measures that are consistent with the Constitution?
You know, they can and they should. And, you know, we don't typically do litigation here in this administration concerning disparate impact. But I will point out that some of the restrictions in some jurisdictions, D.C., Virgin Islands, you know, they actually impact, you know, people of color significantly. And so it's been our view in the Department of Justice today that all Americans of all backgrounds and all stripes and no matter where they live are entitled to the protection of the Second Amendment. And so, you know, that's why people are saying, well, you're taking on this little Virgin Islands. It's a small ball. It's not small ball. The principle is a big one, and it's very important that we establish it throughout the country. That is why, for example, our office, together with the Solicitor General's office, filed a brief in the Walford case involving Hawaii's flipping of the presumption of permission to carry everywhere with a presumption that you have to ask permission every time you cross a property line, which makes it impossible to effectively carry your firearm throughout the day as you run your errands, go check your mail, go to work, go to the grocery store. And so I thought that was a very good argument for the Second Amendment side. And the challengers, the state of Hawaii, I should say rather, had a difficult argument. And I'm hoping that soon the small population of Hawaii will enjoy the same rights as those of us on the mainland as well.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, again, you know, these laws have impacts beyond just the state that's being challenged, right? Because if a state can get away with it, then other states are going to say, aha, well, we can do that too, right? We saw that with the vampire rule. California had its own version that the Ninth Circuit actually found unacceptable. Hawaii's was crafted a little bit differently, which is why it was upheld. But in New York, New Jersey, I think even Montgomery County, Maryland have tried to put in, you know, these vampire rules in place. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we have states that are issuing these one-size-fits-all storage mandates. They might not all be as onerous as the one in the U.S. Virgin Islands in terms of, you know, what you have to buy and how you have to install it. But, you know, a successful lawsuit against a small state like Hawaii or a territory like the Virgin Islands can have a big impact for gun owners all across the country.
You're absolutely correct. And that's why we're taking them on where we see them. And frankly, some of the, you know, far-flung jurisdictions have some of the worst restrictions. And so if you're able to take them out, that sets a new floor for this type of legislation around the country, and it becomes presumptively illegal. Look, I mean, people view Second Amendment rights differently because of all the hype and the rhetoric we've seen out there. You know, Brady Foundation has condemned me for these Colorado lawsuits, but these are fundamental rights. They're no different than the rights that people fought for in the civil rights movement. And states and localities that are denying those rights are no different than the white racist Dixiecrats in the South who were denying integration of our schools. So this denialism is, make no mistake, it's denying us our fundamental rights as Americans, their natural rights. The founders didn't create the rights to defend yourself in the Second Amendment. They recognized the natural right to do so. And that key distinction, I think, is lost on some people.
I think you're right. And I think some people, honestly, they just don't care, right? They don't see it as a right. They see this as some sort of societal wrong that needs to be corrected. But I don't know if you've noticed this, you know, really ever since the Bruin decision was handed down, gun control groups like Brady and Giffords in every town have been proclaiming, you know, everything this administration does is going to lead to, you know, more violent crime. Things are going to get worse. And yet, if you actually look at the crime statistics, I realize the FBI hasn't published the official numbers for 2025, but the Council on Criminal Justice estimates homicide at its lowest rate since the FBI started keeping track in 1960, if not before then. Violent crime plummeting across the country, which is directly contradictory to what the gun control lobby has said is going to happen, right?
Well, at the same time, look, we have crime, but we need to look at the reasons for that crime instead of scapegoating lawful gun owners. I mean, you know, that poor young woman who lost her life in Charlotte, North Carolina, was stabbed. People are being shoved in front of trains in New York City by violent repeat offenders, by illegal aliens, by people who have no business being out on the streets in the first place. And so that's where we're seeing the crime in the headlines. It isn't law-abiding gun owners going on shooting sprees. And if you allow Colorado to call a standard issue magazine large capacity, soon they're going to be calling a 4 magazine round large capacity and 2. There's no end to that definitional abuse. And so we really need to draw these lines and allow people to enjoy their rights and the firearms that they own already and that they'd like to purchase lawfully.
Absolutely. One last question for you. You know, you said last week in another interview that you do believe that the Supreme Court is going to strike down these bans on the so-called assault weapons, that one day they will go away. Do you have any inside information? Are you seeing any tea leaves that the rest of us are not seeing? Because, you know, we saw Snope get relisted 14 or 15 times last term, and then it got denied. We've watched, you know, Duncan versus Bonna, Gators Custom Guns, the challenge to the Cook County gun ban and Connecticut's gun ban have been relisted, I think, each more than a dozen times this term. You talk about that circuit court split, and I think a lot of us anticipate that that split's going to come when the Third Circuit issues its decision in the challenge to New Jersey's gun and magazine ban. Are you hopeful? Are you optimistic? Do you see any sign that the Supreme Court will take one of these hardware cases, even if the Third Circuit doesn't issue its opinion before the end of this term?
Well, first of all, I have no inside information. Okay. I want to be very clear on that. Nobody run to Kalshi, and start placing bets. I have no inside information. I just read the opinions. I read the same tea leaves that everybody else does. And I see the direction that the court has been going. And in fact, the court is applying its Bruin-type jurisprudence to other areas as well and looking at original intent and original meaning in some other fundamental constitutional issues. And so I think when you look at Cargill and when you look at the Smith & Wesson case and you see the court 9-0 in Smith & Wesson saying that AR-15-type rifles are the most popular and widely owned in the United States, I think the conclusion is inexorable that these limitations like Illinois, like Connecticut's, New Jersey's, they're unconstitutional. And so argument went well in the Third Circuit. We'll see what happens. I don't think they have any reason to sit on it. And, hopefully we get some clarity soon for all Second Amendment, freedom-loving, American law-abiding citizens.
Absolutely. Well, Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, again, I really appreciate you joining us on the program today. I look forward to talking to you again in the future. And I guess actually one P.S. question. Barry Arrington, the acting head of the Second Amendment section of the Civil Rights Division. How did he come on your radar? And are you still hiring for the Second Amendment section right now?
Thank you for asking both of those questions. So Barry is someone who I came into contact with through my prior work in private practice concerning representing Second Amendment interests, including National Association of Gun Rights. My former law partner, David Warrington, has represented them for many years, and I think may even have been one of the co-founders of it. And I've been an active member of the NRA and other groups as well. And so we knew of Barry, and I have all these gun groups coming to me and saying, well, Harmy, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? I'm like, well, send us your best lawyers. And so Barry raised his hand in response to that call. And we are so thrilled to have him because he's really lit a fire strategically and with his wealth of knowledge and information and contacts. I think it's been a huge boon to us to see a lawyer like him, who's so talented and knowledgeable, come in to serve his country. It's not easy. People have families back home. I mean, I moved from California here. So you have to really love the Constitution and love civil rights to come here to the swamp from your comfortable home, in his case, in Colorado. We are hiring. And, for people who are not in management roles, there are possibilities for experienced attorneys to actually work in their home states if they're able to work in a United States attorney's office. So if they live near the main city where the U.S. attorney's office is, we are allowing experienced attorneys to work from their home jurisdictions, not from home, but from their home jurisdictions. And that, I think, will open up a lot of opportunities. So whether it's Second Amendment, folks who are watching this, or they're really interested in getting rid of DEI in our schools, or boys and girls sports, or some of the other abuses that we cover in the Civil Rights Division, hate crimes, discrimination against people of faith, might be able to work from where you live already. So give us an email. I think it's usajobs.gov is where our hiring portal is, and we would love to hire more freedom-loving Americans to serve their country.
Excellent. Again, Assistant Attorney General, thank you so much for your time today, and I look forward to continuing the conversation in the future.
Appreciate it. Bye.
My thanks to Harmeet for coming on the program today, and yes, looking forward to continuing that conversation in the future. Also, in the next couple of weeks, we will be talking with ATF Director Robert Sicotte. I'm not sure when that will be, but as soon as we have a date, I will let you know. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Oklahoma. Arcadia Lake suspect was on probation as a youthful offender before mass shooting. You may have heard the news about this shooting. It was at a gathering at Lake Arcadia, just outside of Edmond, Oklahoma. At least one person killed, I believe about a dozen people injured. And as KOKH Fox 25 reports, the one person so far who has been arrested in this case, well known to law enforcement, 18-year-old Jalen Davis, an alleged gang member, has a criminal history that goes back to at least 2024. July of 2023. That's when he was convicted of burglary as a juvenile. And then in May of the following year, he was convicted for illegal possession of a firearm. According to authorities, Jalen Davis also involved in a drive-by shooting in July of 2023, but an arrest warrant in that case was not issued until December of 2024. And the outcome of that case is not known, at least wasn't reported by Fox 25 in Oklahoma City. But again, you've got at least two cases, if not a third case, where authorities could have put Jalen Davis behind bars, even as a juvenile, until he turned 21. And it sounds like in at least two of these cases, and again, we don't know the outcome of that drive-by shooting case, a little more than probation was handed down. He was arrested in or adjudicated for burglary in July of 2023. Less than a year later, he's adjudicated, not arrested, but adjudicated for illegal gun possession in May of 2024. July 1st, 2024, just about 2 months or so after that adjudication for illegal gun possession, court documents say that Davis posted an Instagram video showing him holding a Glock equipped with a switch, had multiple firearms in that video. An arrest warrant was issued in August of 2024. So you've got that case as well. Why wasn't Davis behind bars? And I know that, again, the goal of the juvenile justice system is rehabilitation. It's not incarceration. But when you have somebody who's arrested so many times in such a short amount of time, that to me sets up a glaring red warning sign that what we're doing isn't enough. The consequences that he is experiencing for his criminal actions are not enough to keep him on the straight and narrow, not enough to turn his life around, not enough for him to think about what he is doing. And at that point, I say, even if the goal is rehabilitation, the best route towards rehabilitation involves some significant time behind bars. That didn't happen with Jalen Davis. Now he is facing a number of charges, including murder, for his alleged participation in this mass shooting there in Oklahoma. Now, today's armed citizen story from Florence, South Carolina, where an intruder was shot during a break-in last week. That intruder has now been identified. We don't know if the suspect in question knew the occupants of this home, if this was just some, random home invasion. But according to the Florence Police Department, the suspect, identified as 38-year-old Ryan Christopher Eady, kicked in the door of a home, broad daylight, by the way. I think it was like just before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, managed to get inside before he was shot by somebody inside the home. Nobody inside the home was hurt, according to local police. The investigation does continue, so they've not officially cleared the homeowner, but unless there's, some ancillary charge, maybe the homeowner wasn't allowed to possess a firearm, maybe there was, contraband found inside the home. Police have not said anything, by the way, of that nature, but unless there's something weird like that, I don't anticipate any charges are going to be filed. In South Carolina, if somebody kicks in the door of your home, you can presume they're not there to drop off a pizza. They're there to do you harm. They're there to harm somebody inside the home. You have a reasonable belief that your life is in danger. You have no duty to retreat. You can stand your ground and meet that violent force that was used to break into your home with the force necessary to protect your life and the lives of others. So we'll keep our eyes on that situation and bring you more details as they become available. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a Miami teenager who helped save several neighbors from an apartment fire has now been honored for that heroism with a $6,100 scholarship that will hopefully help him get one step closer to becoming a law enforcement officer himself. That's what he wants to do. Rami Owaza is his name. It was last November. The apartment complex where he lives suffered a fire, and he ended up going door to door to make sure that all of his neighbors were evacuated. At the end of one hallway, he discovered that there was a retired sheriff's deputy who was trapped in the unit where the fire actually had started. Rami's dad, Hassan Awaz, says, "We were looking for him. We didn't see him. And after that, we found out that he went to help some neighbors on the same floor." Rami told Channel 6 in South Florida, he said, "When I'm in school or anywhere really," he said, "I always think about defending those who can't defend themselves. And he said, I know that there's a lot of old people that are in the building that might not be able to get up themselves. So that was the first thing I was thinking about. Rami Waza does hope to become a law enforcement officer. And Miami Police Chief Manny Morales said there's a spot waiting for him on the force. He expressed his eagerness to officially sign up Rami as a Miami police officer once he completes his training through the police academy. But in the right place, at the right time, willing to help a neighbor in need without any expectation of a reward. Rami Uwaza, we thank you for your very, very good deed. And I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program today. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Toby Leary from Cape Gunworks in Massachusetts. Toby's also with the Civil Rights Coalition, taking on Massachusetts Chapter 135 in a referendum that'll be on the ballot this November. So we've got a lot to talk about with Toby, and looking forward to doing that. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. Who knows? Maybe today will be the day we get that Third Circuit decision and a circuit court split on the issue of quote-unquote assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. Now, I will say I'm not holding my breath, but it's got to come out sometime, right? So always a possibility that it could be today. Enjoy the rest of your Monday, as well as Mondays can be enjoyed. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.